Hi, I'm Rhianna Patrick, and thanks for pressing play. Want to know who else I've been hanging out with? Well, take a look at abc.net.au/abcre and join me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Enjoy.
AusYA with Sarah Mair Cox and Gene Wong.
Margo, how did you go about culling that collection of short stories over the time that you've been writing them in a number of different collections and putting it into this one? How did you go about making that cut and making that decision of what made it in?
Well, I did it in concert with two of the Allen and Unwin editors. So we all went through and separately chose what we thought would go together well in a collection. And then we sort of jiggled things and moved things around and made concessions here and there, and finally arrived at a collection of 10 with the three extras. They were actually quite difficult to write. I remember having many, many drafts of all three of them. They all three kind of took it out of me. It was quite interesting. I had lots of fond memories of the times when I used to just sort of sit down and whack out a short story, feeling like I was at the top of my game and it would all be done in 2 days flat. But I think these ones, for having been rethought so many times and worked over and cooked in my subconscious, they're possibly a bit denser, a bit more many-layered than the previous ones. They don't just sort of pick up one idea and go racing off with it. They're a bit more contemplative, I think. They all have their roots in fairy stories and folk tales as well, so they've got similar genetic makeup to the other ones.
Is that how you come up with your short stories, and is that how they come to you, that they're kind of in your subconscious and they might be there for quite a while before you decide to put them on the page?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I sort of collect ideas. I have folders full of tiny scraps of ideas, and sometimes you can sort of artificially generate a story by banging two of them together and watching the sparks from that. And sometimes you have to be a bit more workaday about it. You take one and you know it's based on this fairy story, and often that first redrafting of the fairy story, the first draft is kind of flat, and every individual thing within the story has been changed, but it hasn't actually resulted in a special transmogrification that feels like something that's definitively your kind of thing. So you have to keep on retreating from it and moving parts around and waiting for a spark to happen.
On that, how long could a short story take you if this is the sort of the process that you go through?
It depends on, you know, the various psychological states I go through. It depends on how discouraged I feel when I come up against it, because sometimes, you know, you work and you work through it and it still won't come to life, and so you just need to walk away from it for, you know, a couple of months until you forget the pain you were going through and can come back to it with a fresh eye. But I would say that altogether these three stories would have taken average of 3 months each. Yeah, I'm not saying it's full-time work for 3 months, but I would say, yeah, that feels like the right amount of time, coming back and breaking them apart, putting them back together again, yeah.
And, Margo, in the time that you've been doing this, I mean, you obviously have that sixth sense in yourself of knowing when you feel as though that story is starting to come to life, and yeah, you feel like you're on a roll.
Mm-hmm.
When do you know that point? For you, I mean, when do you know, yes, this is starting to go the way that I want it to go?
I think it's when, it's just like when you're picking up a book in a bookshop and trying to work out which one you're going to read. It's that feeling of just, it's not really a decision to go on reading. It's just all of a sudden you're dragged in and you're part of that story. It's the same from the writer's point of view when it's working. Just all of a sudden the afternoon is gone and you've been so totally focused that even the part of yourself that normally tracks your progress has been focused on the story, and you've completely lost sight of the real world for a short time.
Margot, in this collection, there are stories that go from an ogre in disguise, two sisters burying a stolen moon, a ferryman plying his trade. I feel like I've read the darker stories in this collection because I was particularly drawn to Winky, which is about Wee Willy Winky, and also Red Nose Day, which I have so many questions for you about. But with Winky, man, you really took that to a dark place.
Yeah, it's pretty scary, isn't it? I didn't actually realise how scary it was until I read it aloud at a convention once and finished up, and there was just this silence and everybody was sort of staring quiet in their seats, horrified.
I mean, it's like extremely dark, and it follows this young girl. And I wondered if part of the story too was also tied up in her anxiety about this new baby and where that played into all of this. But the thing that really got me, I think, was it a dream or did it happen? I couldn't work out where reality stopped and started.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely wasn't supposed to be a dream. I didn't want it to have that cop out. I want it to be a real experience. And that's, there's sort of the key to that is there at the very end when her mother talks to her about this
thing.
Wee Willy Winky.
Yes.
Person
without spoilers.
Monster.
Yeah.
So she knows about this sort of predatory thing that's out there and hunting children for their eyelids, you know, it's something that mothers know. Well, it's not so much something that mothers know. It's more she had a sense that her own daughter was in danger, even though they weren't in the same house. And it was her instincts that told her to send the men out to hunt for the girl. So She knew the state that her daughter was in, and she knew that she needed rescuing, which I suppose if you want to, you could psychoanalyze and say, yes, she's making sure that this child gets the attention that is being stolen from her by this new baby. But maybe that monster is out there waiting for older sisters.
So how did you go from Wee Willy Winky that we may know to the Winky that we read in this story? I mean, where does that all come from?
Well, yeah, my mum asked me the same question. I was reading a book by Marina Warner, which is called No Go the Boogeyman. And she mentioned Wee Willy Winky as a scary idea. And I thought, Wee Willy Winky, that little guy in the white nightgown, you know, with the friendly face and the candle. How scary is that? And then I thought, oh, but of course, it could, anything going around the streets, rapping on windows and prying at locks and hissing at children is, of course, incredibly sinister. And so all I did was make him physically more sinister, so make him tall enough to knock on upstairs windows and peer into those and make him thin and just transform him a tiny bit and he became this terrible creature. And then, of course, things like his name. Why is he called Wee Willy Winky? He's called Wee because he's not Wee, because he's tall. So you call him the opposite thing to sort of conquer your fear. And he's called Winky because he doesn't have eyelids. He's got these terrible, starry eyes. And, of course, the problems that arise from that send him out on his terrible mission. So there's kind
I'm
of
really
a
se- creeped out by it.
Because there's kind of a set of clues in the verse and a set of clues just in the title which send me off onto the darker possibilities. Because I'm against saccharineness in nursery rhymes in general. So my project is really to take them apart.
I think you did that well.
Some shadows. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely well in Winky. But I mean, are there points like when you have gone back and you've read some of the stories in here and you've thought, gee, I did really, how did I get that dark? How did I get that creepy? Because you haven't realised until you've read them out loud or you've reread them.
Yeah, well, I think when you're writing them, you're living them in a sort of a way, but you're also trying to do all the technical things that will make that experience, the reading experience, a lively one. Sometimes I go back and I realise I have pushed the darkness too far and it is melodramatic or it is, you know, getting a bit ridiculous. You want to create real fear. You don't want to sort of turn it into a caricature of fear. You don't want it to be sort of I sort of am a horror writer, but I'm not a sort of a...
You're not a horror writer on purpose.
Yeah, I'm sort of not, I guess I'm not an R.L. Stein type of horror writer. You know, I'm not a cliffhanger and scream kind of horror writer.
You just go dark without realising you've gone dark.
I want to take people's emotions to different, darker places, yeah.
And is that something that is, you know, what makes a great short story is about tapping into someone's emotion and taking them on that ride despite the story being quite short?
I sometimes think of short stories as being like the climactic chapter of a novel. You get sort of all the benefits without all the business of laying down the groundwork for it. So you have to be very, very efficient about implying the groundwork in a lot of cases. You refer to things that you have never explained, but the naming of them or the way you describe them indicates enough about them for the person to get their hooks into the story and catch the sense of it as you're dragging them towards that big climax at the end.
And when it came to Red Nose Day, I did wonder to myself, Margot, whether you just don't like clowns, whether there was something deeper in what that story was about. And I loved the ending, not going to give that away, but I did not see that coming.
Oh, good. Yeah. Now, I've never been real keen on certain types of clowns. You know, I remember disliking those kind of knockabout violent clowns in the circus when I was quite small. And, of course, they have quite a rich heritage in horror movies and books, and they're often used as a kind of a horror trope. Yeah, I thought it was particularly creepy if you not only made them these terrible false-faced creatures, but you put them in charge of the country. You made them actually run things rather than just being the creatures that kind of diffuse people's fear or prompt people's laughter. And though actually, the longer I look at clowns, the stranger their function seems to me.
And you mentioned that. I mean, in the story, there's this whole conversation that happens between the two characters who also are taking out their dislike of clowns in a particular way.
Yeah.
But you talk about, the big players, the brand names, and then the hobbyists and the amateurs in this. And, you know, I got the feeling that when it comes to clowns, you have a hierarchy of the ones that you think are doing the job well and those who, yeah, nah.
Yeah. I'll definitely. Yeah. I saw a really good show called Slava's Snow Show, which is Russian clowns. And, you know, there are not many clown shows that I would actually pay money to go and see. But this one was exactly the kind of clown that I like. It was atmospheric and strange and loud and full of pathos, but not that, not the super mawkish pathos that sometimes clowns indulge in. It was really cool. You get a chance. If they come back to Australia, see them.
And Margot, I mean, this Singing My Sister Down and Other Stories collection has been out for a little while. Mm-hmm. But what is your hope that the reader gets out of these short stories? And, you know, what would you like them to walk away with, which doesn't involve probably a fear of clowns or going to sleep at night?
Or things under their bed.
Or
at the window. I think I would just like them to have that experience that I had writing them, which is being taken somewhere else, being taken out of normal life. I would like them to be carried past their stops on public transport because they were reading one of these stories and they needed to get to the end, or they didn't realise, they forgot they were on the train, and then they look up at the end and realise they've gone too far. I would like them to have that amount of impact.
Maybe that's a story in itself, Margot. Margot.
Notes it down.